serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I don't know about you, but I want to have a mind like Henry Mizuki's mind if I'm ever blessed to reach 101 years old. But let's go back to when he was 26 years old. His first attempt to join the Army had been denied because he was classified 4C, enemy alien, as a result of his Japanese heritage, even though he'd been born in California. In the spring of 1945, Henry was finally heading overseas with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
Halfway through going over to the Mediterranean, there was a commotion on the ship, and all of a sudden we found out the Germans had ended the war. So we were right about ready to go through the Gibraltar. The ship that I was on was loaded with the 5th Army veterans that were going back for the second tour of duty. But anyway, we found out there was a big roar on that ship when people found out the war was ended. But we continued on. We did land in Naples. We followed the activities of where the 442 had traveled from Naples on up to the French border. When we got there, I had joined some of the other members of the latecomers with the 442 in a town, I think it was Gedi, Italy. We were stationed at an airport, and at nighttime we could see this row of trucks coming down the mountainside to surrender. They were German soldiers surrendering at the Gedi airport. But I didn't see any action, and I don't have a combat infantry badge.
You were heading that way to be a replacement with the 442nd, and one of the reasons they needed replacements was because the severe casualty rate. And had you heard of that before you're heading that way?
I don't think so. We knew that they were running into some heroics. We knew that.
So how long did they keep you over there in Europe?
Quite a bit. They formed the remainders of the 442 as an anti-riot, I guess, unit. And they gave us a lot of four-wheel trucks. I forgot the name of them. We had the armored vehicles. We were always on the ready. And one time we were called to go down to Barrie because there was a riot down there and they wanted us to quell it. But I had been named a supply sergeant for our company. I had a Jeep and a driver as a supply sergeant. I wasn't even supposed to drive my own Jeep. But we had a 4x4, I guess we called it, loaded up with ammunition, mortars. It was supposed to be on the ready all the time. And then they also gave us a horse. And I was the only one that could ride the horse because most of the guys were from Hawaii and they had never ridden a horse before. But anyway, from my training in Montana, they gave us a horse. And I said, oh, I'll ride the horse. We stayed there until the war. Oh, and something happened right after the war. They gathered, I think about 75 of us, they told us to gather at the mess hall. And everybody kind of looked at it. They all came from different parts of the remaining 442. Company G? No. Company F? Company C? So it wasn't organized. And I thought, why are you here? Well, they said, gentlemen, you're here because we selected you. We went through your MOS and we find that you can speak Japanese. They said, what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to go through a specific amount of training. Only after you go to your home, you'll get a 30-day reprieve. You can go home and visit your family, but you'll be ordered to go back there. I guess it was Snelling or someplace, the same place my brother went through. And he said, we're going to ask you to become a I don't know, some sort of a thing where we were going to infiltrate the Japanese lines and gather information. Said, you'll be under protection all the time, but we don't want you to tell anybody what you were going to do. So those of you who want to volunteer, stay behind. The rest of you can go. As I recall, I don't think anybody stayed behind. I guess not. Well, most of us were new. I don't think we had seen combat, but there were a few who had seen combat. But nobody wanted to continue to go to the Pacific. And the funny part of this was in St. Louis. I was a photographer, and a major part of my work at that time was taking photos of buildings. One day, I forgot the name, Bill something or another, said, hey, let's go fishing. I said, fine. Where? He said, Montana. Montana? I said, okay. Because, well, we had been there before, and he knew that I'd been fishing in Wyoming, Montana, Yellowstone, that area. We were going to meet some of his friends up in West Yellowstone, I think, or... And we were driving through Montana, and he said, see that over there? He said, I was part of building that. And up on the northern perimeter of the United States at that time, they had built a tremendous number of anti-missile fortifications. And he was the youngest brigadier general in the U.S. at that time. I've forgotten his name, Bill something. And he said, I was in charge of building all of that. I said, really? He said, yes. And he said, but they pulled me off of that and sent me back to Washington. And they said, we want you to lead a group of people that we're going to enroll or whatever it was. It's a counterintelligence thing. He said, they're all Japanese Americans, and we're getting them to... see if we can send them over to the Pacific to enter. Well, that was the great plan, and he was going to lead it. I said, Bill, do you know who that was? He said, well, I was supposed to be one of them, and I don't know. We didn't volunteer. He said, yeah. I said, the unit broke up because nobody wanted to volunteer. I said, that was us. But we came back, and eventually they disbanded the whole unit, and we came back. But you probably know that when the whole unit came back, they marched for Truman.
So are you one of those guys in that picture of Truman reviewing? No?
No, we're the ones that left behind in Italy and stayed another 3 or 4 months or 6 months.
What do you think would have happened if you had stayed in that room and you had volunteered for what sounds like some pretty dangerous assignments?
I talked to Skip about that. He was in a kind of a protected unit, and he said that whenever he was in the army, there were either one or two Caucasian soldiers with 45s standing, and when they were marching by Japanese, they thought he was a prisoner. They didn't realize that he was an American, but he was under protection constantly because he could be sniped at if he were just running around free. I don't know what would have happened to us. I felt that I was better in Japanese than Skip was. I am no longer that way because I have lost contact with Japanese.
Just being a part of the 442, being able to wear that emblem, what has that meant to you over the years?
There's a certain camaraderie, whether you're a member, the active or participant in the war, or whether you're just a replacement. If you're a 442, you're a 442. The unit included you, and they didn't just say, oh, you're a replacement, so it doesn't make any difference. If you're an overseas 442, you're given the same respect.
Well, and you mentioned respect, and I'm thinking of, well, I guess it's almost a decade ago now when all Nisei veterans of World War II were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal.
I came here to Fresno to get mine.
So that's something that you can display, but the legacy is much more than a medal or any of the countless medals that were earned by the 442. When you think about the 442 and the MIS and all these Americans of Japanese ancestry who are risking their lives for a country that was holding their families behind barbed wire. What is the legacy? What do you think you guys proved?
Ask him. Yeah, ask him to see what he says.
Henry's referring to his son, Howard, so let's find out what he says. Howard, what is your perspective on your father and your uncle and the rest of the Nisei veterans of World War II?
What I think about is relevant is they were unselfish in their service. They put their country and their family ahead of the politics, and they served just, you know, without reservation. I think a great many Americans now still feel the same way, but you know, there's certainly a group that may not feel that same way. They may feel like, you know, the country's done them some disservice in some certain way, and so they don't owe the country anything. But, I mean, if you look at the spirit of what they did and the belief that we had this country that wasn't perfect, certainly had a lot of faults and a lot of mistakes, but was worthy of maintaining and serving and protecting that freedom, it's an unbelievable act of courage.
Well, what do you think, Henry? You think he summed it up okay?
Well, I guess so. Well, I lived in Missouri. President Truman was a native of Missouri. I always stopped by the Truman Library in Independence. Every time I go there, I think, here's a guy that dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, killed my blood uncle, which we have seen. But on the other hand, he ordered the Japanese-American unit to come march down Pennsylvania Avenue without fanfare, but he did actually salute the unit as they marched on the presidential grounds. And no other unit in the U.S. Army has ever been accorded that honor of marching for the president on the presidential grounds. And I think that there may be a lot of people who don't appreciate what we did as Japanese Americans during World War II, but here's a president who I, in one portion, dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but at the same time accorded Japanese American citizens the honor that he thought they deserved.
Later on, President Truman would integrate the armed forces so neither Japanese Americans nor African Americans nor any other groups would ever be forced into segregated units again. But there was also that other decision he made with the use of the atomic bomb. And if people were listening, they heard you say you lost an uncle in Hiroshima. So this was your mother's brother. How did you all find out what happened to him?
After the war, we came home, and I think the family was back in Sanger. I guess my mother found out her older brother had been killed in the war, and it was unnecessary for him to get killed. I don't know how distant it was from the bombing. We have seen it, Howard and I, in Caroline. We went there one year, and we saw the effects of the bomb. But they have a different feeling. They were amazed that we were interested in looking at the site because they said, we never go there. What happened was my uncle who died was a grain merchant. He had taken a little bag of grain that he was going to sell to some wholesaler or whatever it was, and they told him not to go. The family told him, the rest of the family, the small community, I guess, the integrated community, said every morning there's this airplane comes flying at 8 o'clock in the morning. He said, don't go. But he went, and he rode his bicycle, and the bomb struck. A man found his bicycle leaning against the... They never did find his body. One day they found a man riding his bicycle. He had his license, his name or license number on the bicycle. They said, where did you find the bicycle that belongs to you? I said, if it's your bicycle, please take it. I didn't mean to steal it. I found it on. I said, where did you find it? They said, I found it here. And underneath that bicycle was the grain was sprouting. And that's where they have put a post and marked it as the last resting place of my uncle in Hiroshima. So that's the story. You know, that they told my mother.
Wow. And I know just from the Nisei veterans I've had the privilege of meeting over the years that you're not the only one who lost a relative because of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I know we're getting close to the end of our time together, but we've got to hear this story. How did you meet the Pope?
After the war, the unit that remained was guarding the transport of UNRWA goods from Naples, Italy, on up to, well, Germany. And so we had this exchange of soldiers going over the relief a certain line, and then the second unit would take it on up north to the Austrian border. One day, there was a Japanese guy from Hawaii. He said he'd never worn shoes until he got into the army. Anyway, I said, let's go on this trip. He said, I'm going to do some inspection, so you might as well. And so I cut myself an order and gave it to, and well, I sort of was able to forge the commanding officer's name. But anyway, we went to Rome, and we walked around and saw the old ruins and the Colosseum and things, and went over to St. Peter's, and I was amazed at the statue. You know, they look small in the pictures, but they're tremendous. And we're wandering around, and this priest comes along, and he says, would you like to meet the Pope? I said, I'm a Buddhist. I don't know what he is. Doesn't make any difference. Come meet the Pope. And so enough, he led us into the Sistine Chapel, and he blessed us. And that's what Howard wanted me to relate.
I mean, that kind of is a unique story. I don't think there's many guys who have had that kind of audience with the Pope.
No, I keep telling all my Catholic neighbors, look, I'm better than you if I've ever seen the Pope. I've been blessed by the Pope. So that's the end.
Well, I do have one more question, because, well, two really. 101 years old now, is there something that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I think that obviously being in this country and having the opportunity, even after the war experiences, that we're able to raise our kids and give them the opportunity to do whatever they want to do without any restrictions. It's a wide open country. We've been to Japan. It's very tight. It's regimented. The country is small, so you abide by certain customs. The Americans, my kids, aren't able. They can do whatever they want. So I don't think I could have done this in other countries. Maybe so, I could, but I don't know, in America.
I realize you have a whole life's worth of experiences here at 101 years old. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for talking to us. You're 101 years old. You don't look like it. You don't sound like it. You don't act like it. So I'm sure everybody wants to know, what's your secret in being in this kind of shape and this active at 101?
Genes, I guess.
The expression of those genes once made him a captive in the very country where he was born. Now, if they really are the secret to his longevity, they're giving him the chance to share his unique story with the rest of us as he approaches his 102nd birthday in January. That's all the time we have on the radio. You will find some additional memories from Henry Mizuki in the extended podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.